Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Dr. Eben Alexander was a neurosurgeon who in 2008 contracted a very aggressive bacterial infection that put him into a coma for 7 days. When he awoke, he described an experience whereby he travelled to another plane of existence and of being guided by a spinning globe of light through a valley filled with waterfalls. All while having the meaning of life and existence described to him directly into his mind, Dr. Alexander documented his experience in his 2012 book titled Proof of Heaven, A Neurologist's Journey Through the Afterlife. It's available on Amazon for $12. No promo. In February of 2006, Anita Morjani suffered with complete organ failure due to end-stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. Morjani described traveling outside of her body and hearing a conversation her husband was having with a doctor down the hall from her hospital bed. She was then whisked away to another dimension, in her words, where she experienced feelings of true love, pure peace within, and goodness all around her. All this while having the meaning of life explained to her. Miraculously, Morjani recovered and went on to write a book about her experience titled Dying to Be Me. Once again, no promo. Don Piper, a Christian Baptist minister from California, was struck by an 18-wheel semi-trailer truck while driving home from a church conference in 1989. Don was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash, but 90 minutes later, his pulse unexpectedly returned. Don described traveling to a shimmering silver gate and being surrounded by deceased relatives that he had not seen in many years, including his late grandfather. He describes his conversation with those dead relatives in his New York Times bestseller titled 90 Minutes in Heaven, also available on Amazon for just £9.99. Or indeed, watch the movie version starring Hayden Christensen. You know, Darth Vader with a mustache. In 2003, 3-year-old Colton Burpo underwent emergency surgery for a ruptured appendix. Young Colton awoke describing a conversation that he had with his late great-grandfather, whom he had never met. He also described riding on a rainbow-coloured horse with Jesus Christ. Yep, you guessed it. Book and movie both titled Heaven is for Real. Available on Amazon now. Get it while it's hot. So, some people have made a lot of money from near-death experiences, which I suppose makes it really easy for you and I to roll our eyes at the entire phenomenon. But in tonight's episode, I'm going to try to do the hard thing and actually take this phenomenon seriously. Because not everybody that has gone through this experience has tried to monetize it. In fact, a lot of people have had this experience. Gallup and Ipsos Mori polls indicate between 4 and 8% of the United States population, to be exact, which equates to between 13 to 26 million people in the United States alone. That number is 31% for British people at 20.7 million folks. A further 150,000 people in Australia, and 74.2 million people across the European continent. In fact, to look at it in these terms, in the United States and Europe, the number of people who experience an NDE, or near-death experience, is equal in number to the amount of people who identify as LGBT. So numbers that are so significant, they are acknowledged the world over as to be a legitimate commonality. If you understand what I'm trying to say. So I think it's fair to say that with these figures, that this phenomenon is real and is happening with extreme regularity. And as medical science progresses and more people are being brought back from the brink of death, this seems to be happening more than ever. So let's take a look into the facts and reality of this phenomena and examine some of the explanations for why it happens, including one theory that I'm fairly certain you are very unlikely to have considered before. To many people, any stories regarding near-death experiences just sound plain crazy. Accounts are often categorized or filed under paranormal phenomena at best and as plain hokey pseudoscience at worst. Many folks out there automatically discount anybody who claims to have had such an experience. And why wouldn't they? Particularly the secular-minded. After all, a near-death experience is directly linked in some way to religion, correct? But we all experience dreams, right? Hell, some of those dreams or nightmares are downright scary in nature. Also, right? We've all had a fever dream, for example. And some of you out there may have even kept a dream diary to track and log them, and no doubt, if you do, can attest to the often bizarre scenarios that play out during them. Well, dreams are a very real, scientifically proven phenomenon, and no one can dispute their existence, regardless of how crazy they may sound. Now, to be clear, this is all I'm trying to say at this point. Yes, there are people who try to make money and push their agendas using near-death experiences, and they can occasionally sound kind of crazy at times, but they do happen an awful lot. Now, I'm aware I'm generalizing with the term quote-unquote crazy here too. Please don't write me. I mean it in the loosest and most jargonistic sense, of course. Now, I know this will dip into some metaphysical territory, and some of you guys may not be super comfortable with that. But try and bear with me on this one, as before I can get to the science, I first have to address the other side of the coin, and the faith-based options. Now, one thing that separates NDEs from dreams is that dreams tend to be kind of all over the place. It's also very difficult to interpret a meaning or purpose to dreams, despite what the psychic or lady who lives with 15 cats down the block may tell you. Well, near-death experiences tend to be strikingly similar. Evidence-based correlation and everything. At least, at surface level. Some of the basic elements that tend to occur in NDEs include out-of-body experience, travelling through a tunnel, seeing a bright light, interacting with the spirits of deceased loved ones, a lifetime review where your life is presented to you, feelings of peace and love, and finally the existence of having the meaning of life and the fundamental reality of existence explained to you. According to a 1991 Belgian study in the scientific research journal Frontiers in Science, these near-death characteristics might be prevalent in the vast majority of near-death experiences, but they are not always in that specific order. The order seems to be a bit more random depending on the individual. Now, if it needs to be said that not everybody who gets pulled back from the brink of death will encounter a near-death experience, in fact, only about 15% according to a 2009 Gallup poll. There are also the unfortunate outliers whose experiences are anything but peaceful and serene, with about 1% of those reporting a near-death experience describe going to some kind of, well, hell. Everything from fire pits to desolate blank voids to demons eating flesh and so on. And of course, no doubt, speakers playing Nickelback. You know, really horrific and tortuous scenarios. For now though, let's stick with a classic near-death experience and examine what could be causing this phenomenon. The first theory on our list is, well, whether your soul goes to heaven. You are all aware of Occam's razor. Well, Occam's razor states, quote, all things being equal, the simplest answer is usually the correct one, unquote. A standard and basic rule within scientific and research circles. So based on that, the simple answer for the near-death experience being somebody going to heaven is just that people are actually going to heaven. But I'd like to think you know me better than that. All things are not equal in this case, so based on Occam's razor, unfortunately the simplest answer is not that people are just going to heaven. I'm sorry. Some of the other explanations on this list actually have some kind of scientific basis behind them. Whereas the idea of actually going to heaven is only anecdotal in nature, Further, it contains a license on completely unproven phenomenon, which, simply put, is never the simplest explanation. Physical analysis, measured data, and proven theory are far simpler from a scientific perspective. I don't say that to be completely discounting of anecdotal evidence, however. Hell, a lot of episodes in this very show have their origins in anecdotal evidence. But we will always fall back and rely on the science to provide the groundwork for the theories that we ultimately put forward. When given the choice between experimental and anecdotal evidence, I'll pick the experimental every time. However, hold on to this thought for now, and we'll come back to it in a short while. Now, having said all this, there are plenty of things within science that we only have indirect experience of, but we still firmly believe. Dark matter and dark energy, for example. We have indirect evidence of it, but we have still never directly observed it. Many people will make the argument that the belief in an afterlife has been a part of religious and cultures within civilizations all the way back to the very beginning of time. So maybe we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss those either. Of course, the response to that would be that wrestling with our own mortality has of course led to the belief in the afterlife because it serves as a bit of a salve to take away the existential angst. After all, we're exceptionally good at lying to ourselves. So this can, obviously, go back and forth forever. I just felt like it should be included in this episode in the interest of being thorough and balanced. So there. And like I said, we will come back to this theory later, but for now, we'll move on. Theory number two, an NDE, is where you are rejoining a universal consciousness. There are now some scientists who put forward and believe that at a fundamental level, the universe is made up of and created by consciousness itself. Believers use this to explain things like the double slit experiment in quantum entanglement, although experts would say that this is based more on misunderstandings of those things than of actual reality. But in this worldview, consciousness is not something that's created by the brain, rather it's something that kind of flows through the brain. It's hypothesized that the structure of our brains only makes up our sense of self, so our experience of consciousness is filtered through that self and is created within the brain. So in this specific theory, when you die, what's really dying is your inner self, and your experience of consciousness continues through the universal consciousness. Hence quantum entanglement theory. Okay, so we are getting in fairly deep now. So, for those of you who aren't familiar with the theory of quantum entanglement, allow me to explain. I'll try and make this as user-friendly and layman as I possibly can. So let's start talking about the weirdness of the quantum world. A guanine and scientifically observed phenomena that stands head and shoulders above the rest when it comes to weirdness. It seems to defy all the laws of physics as we know it, and that's quantum entanglement, or as Albert Einstein called it, spooky action at a distance. Genuine quote. So, automatic particles are measured through several sets of data according to their location in space-time. This is also known as its information. One of these singular vectors is called spin, which is a function of the particle's angular momentum. Of course, this being the quantum world, it's not as simple as just an object rotating. The spin is released in quantum packets, which require the particle to be given a quantum number. And one of the theory rules is that particles can't change its speed of rotation, but it can change the direction of its rotation, which is understandable. Now, there's a lot of science and mathematical equations to support the figure generation for the rotation of a particle. But suffice to say, scientists have figured out a way to do it, and it's actually very reliable. So now that we understand spin, let's step back a little bit. For those of you listening who are frantically Googling this information in an attempt to understand and digest it further, then check out the double slit experiment. By the way, I apologize if this episode is science heavy for those of you who don't connect with the subject. But I think it's the only genuine and credible way to discuss this type of subject matter, so as it doesn't sound like tinfoil hat kind of stuff. Anyway, Subatomic particles exist in probability states, also known as superposition. This means that they exist in all positions at the same time until they are measured, which causes their waveform to collapse, at which point you can measure its spin. Before the waveform collapses, it is spinning in all directions at once. Now imagine that one of those photons was split into two parts while in said superposition. This, as it turns out, is fairly easy to do by shining light through the right type of crystal lattice onto the particle. So now you have two separate particles, both in superposition. What would happen if you measured one of them? Would both of their waveforms collapse, or just the one that you measured? Well, as it turns out, they would both collapse. The changes you made in one particle automatically and simultaneously affects the other particle irrespective of distance. This is crazy, right? You observe one, then the other collapses. You change the spin of one, and the other one changes too. This all happens instantaneously. To reiterate, no matter how far apart the particles are. Scientists have produced this experiment. It's actual proven theory. And to clarify, even if the particles are in two separate galaxies millions of light years apart, they change direction instantaneously. This is essentially quantum entanglement. Everything everywhere is everything all at once. Of course, this breaks all kinds of physical laws. How does this information travel faster than the speed of light, for example? Especially given the speed of light being the fastest thing in the known universe. The answer to that question is as alien to scientists as it is to me and you. It's far more than just a strange quirk of the quantum world, though. The Big Bang theory specifically states that all matter started from a single point and spread outwards, right? Well, this means that there can be entangled particles all over the universe. In fact, every particle could be entangled with another particle or groups of particles or even billions of particles. And every time we measure a particle or change its spin, we are actually affecting other particles all over the universe. There's even a theory by our old friend John Archibald Wheeler called One Electron Universe Theory, which is exactly what it sounds like. It theorizes that every electron in the known universe is the same electron traveling backwards and forwards in time on a world line that has been folded up on top of itself, like a giant knot. Anyway, I'll give you a second to put your brain back into your head on that one. You really can see why Einstein had a real problem with quantum entanglement as a thing, can't you? He never fully accepted it. He and several other scientists came up with the alternative theories that they called loopholes. Unfortunately for Einstein and his friends, new experiments are erasing the loopholes one by one and proving once and for all that quantum entanglement is a real phenomenon. In October 2015, researchers at Oxford University's CAVI Institute of Nanoscience in the UK were able to connect on a quantum level two particles at a distance of 1.3 kilometres, which is, to this point, the furthest they have ever been able to physically replicate the experiment. Future experiments aim to lengthen this distance. There's even one in the works where scientists are going to send a quantumly entangled particle up to the International Space Station. Fun times, right? Anyway, now that you're all an expert on quantum entanglement, let's skip back to where we were. In the case of a near-death experience, the body would become revived, and the brain would start to boot back up, along with the inner self that had just faded away into the quantum realm. Now, it needs to be said that while this idea is rotated in actual science, it is not necessarily embraced by the whole scientific community. Sure, it has its supporters in scientific circles, but generally it is still kind of fringy stuff. But here's how it all fits together. I've talked about the Global Consciousness Project and how changes in human emotion can actually affect the patterns and random number generators, basically insinuating that our consciousness can affect the physical world. This, of course, would tie into the idea that all matter and energy is tied into an underlying field of consciousness. Underlying fields, of course, which you could argue sounds a lot like quantum field theory, which does have substantial research and acceptance within the scientific community. While quantum entanglement is a genuine thing, not all scientists agree that near-death experiences are linked directly to it. But it would make a lot of sense scientifically. Then there's the Orch-OR model, which was suggested by Stuart Homaroff and Roger Penrose. They postulate that microtubules in the neurons of our brains could serve as a sort of quantum qubits that could transmit information through quantum entanglement in and out of our brains. This could be the mechanism that allows for our brains to communicate with that underlying universal consciousness. Now, there is a whole lot of unanswered elements to this theory in order for it to work, and it does feel slightly like we are patching over some holes in our understanding with quantum theory, which is also something that we don't fully understand. And this is why the theory is not completely embraced, essentially. So, what in that case is supported by the overall scientific community? Well, theory number three, and the generally accepted theory by scientists, is that it's all a hallucination caused by a flood of hormones and chemicals in the brain at the time of death. Major buzzkill. Now, as I stated earlier, there are several components to the classical near-death experience. All of those can be described by different physical things that take place within the brain at the time of death. For example, those who experience carbon dioxide poisoning can often experience tunnel vision or seeing a blinding light. Obviously, when your heart stops beating, carbon dioxide is not being pumped out of your brain, so it can build up and cause this effect. The whole lifetime review and meeting of dead relatives scenario is often explained by the fact that the memory center within the temporal lobe is one of the last places in the brain to shut down at the time of death. Out-of-body experiences can actually be kind of created by manipulating the temporal perennial junction in the brain. This being the part of the brain that creates a sense of connectedness to the body. Interesting stuff. And finally, here's the rock star. DMT. Don't worry, I'll refrain from going all Joe Rogan on you at this point. But dimethyltryptamine is an endogenous psychedelic, or in other words, it's a chemical produced inside of the human body. People who take DMT often experience feelings of love and connectedness to the universe as a whole, given its intense hallucinogenic properties. It's actually a Class A or Schedule 1 drug in almost all countries, which is interesting considering you and everyone else is producing it right now inside of your own body. It also creates an artificial near-death experience, if you will. In fact, it's commonly referred to as the spirit molecule for that exact reason. It facilitates what they call, quote-unquote, ego death, meaning the inner self that I talked about earlier kind of fades away. In fact, it makes for a very powerful treatment for people who are terminally ill, helping them to kind of come to grips with their own death or mortality. It's one of the main ingredients in traditional Amazonian ayahuasca, a strong ceremonial psychoactive brew that is used within the culture for shamanic purposes. What's interesting about DMT is people's experiences on the hallucinogen are strikingly similar. It's not just that they're having these experiences, it's that they're all having the same experiences. Something's particularly unique to this substance and this substance alone. Geometric patterns, feelings of floating, connecting to an unseen entity? Could it be that they're all connecting to the same source, something outside of themselves? And if so, how does that work? It is also believed by many researchers that at the time of death, the brain floods itself with DMT to create the near-death experience. But why? Well, some of those same researchers suggest that the DMT is actually something of a chemical catalyst for spiritual detachment. That it's not just a hallucinogenic trigger, but that it's actually a kind of opening to a window to another level of consciousness or dimension, so to speak. Or it's just nature's way of smoothing the transition into death a little bit. Possibly something to take away the anxiety of death and help us to let go, transition into whatever comes next. But once again, why? Why would nature care at all that we are having a smooth transition and a comfortable death? Why would we have evolved to a place where this happens? Also, if it happens at death, then evolutionary genetic learning could never take place, as it's at that point of life cessation, so it couldn't be developed upon. Evolution just doesn't work that way. A smoother transition into death does absolutely nothing to move our genes or evolution forward. It's useless in terms of evolution. And if we have this ability, but it wasn't put there by evolution, then why is it there, and how did it get there? Or, who put it there, if you were contemplating intelligent design here? It could be argued that DMT and all these other hormones are released for the same reason that our bowels release when we die. Things just kind of let go or switch off. A pretty gross analogy to think about, but factual nonetheless. But the point is, we don't know what that mechanism is or why it happens. As in the DMT, not the bowels. It just goes to show that even if you go to the most reductionist, physicalist explanation for near-death experiences, there's still a lot of unanswered questions around it. The fact of the matter is that generally, NDEs are discussed in the same breath as ghosts, aliens, paranormal phenomena, and cryptids. But the reality is that near-death experiences are real. They are a genuine phenomena, but are completely without information and explanation within science. Research, and particularly funding for said research, is scarce at best. You will often find in scientific circles that if science and or scientists are completely unable to provide answers for, or even a realistic and likely proposition for a seemingly eccentric or far-reaching problem, that it's often categorized as fringe or pseudoscience. The peer pressure and sense of image within the scientific community is at high school levels, and that's not even a joke. NDEs seem to generally fall into this category, even though it's almost universally accepted as genuine scientific phenomena. I guess the line between science and religion meet at this very juncture, which understandably causes some scientists unease and discomfort. While I was conducting research for this episode, I came across the following thoughts on the subject. I thought I would include them here, as it's a unique take on the subject. It's called technological resurrection. There's a well-known quote from Arthur C. Clarke that says, quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic," unquote. It's often called Clarke's third law. For example, if you were to travel back in time by some 300 years with an iPhone and show people from that time that you have this flat rectangle that you can capture people's likenesses, that lights up from the inside, that plays music and sounds, that if you press a combination of buttons you could talk to another person thousands of miles away in another part of the world, then I think it's fair to say that they would probably burn you at the stake. It's actually a time travel movie trope at this point. But even the smartest person in existence at that time would be completely unable to comprehend the iPhone and how it worked, and to them it would come across as nothing short of pure wizardry, witchcraft and magic. Similarly, we easily accept that future humans or a super intelligent and advanced AI will be able to do things that at this moment we couldn't possibly comprehend or explain. Things that we may consider to be magic now, or at least a nuanced version of it. Things like curing any disease, recreating entire bodies, transferring consciousness, teleportation, faster than light speed travel, or even time travel. Well, none of that is beyond the realm of possibility and does exist in the laws of physics. What the idea of technological resurrection does is basically bring all of that together. The idea is that in the future, we might be able to transfer a person's consciousness out of their body in the moments just before death and put it into a physical avatar, or maybe into a virtual world. Essentially transferring your consciousness to another plane after your biological body has come to the end of its natural life cycle. Now sure, it's an idea we've all heard many times before. But what if they could actually do that through time? They can actually manipulate time and go back and do that for dead relatives, meaning the experience you have at the time of death is not passing into another realm, but transporting into the future. Some of this thought direction ties into a late 1800s philosophy called Russian Cosmism. Well, Russian Cosmism is facing a bit of a resurrection among Silicon Valley types at the moment. It's a blend of spirituality and technology that's centered on the idea of someday we will be able to revive our ancestors and also travel into the cosmos. The movement was started by a Russian philosopher, Lev Nikolai Fedorov, who was known as the Socrates of Moscow in Russian circles. He was close friends with Leo Tolstoy and Konstantin Tchaikovsky, the father of Russian rocketry. Fedorov and the Cosmism movement were the early precursors of the transhumanism movement that wants to merge humans with technology. This idea of immortality through technology is championed by some of the most respected thinkers in the world today, including Roy Kurzweil and Peter Thiel. They think that we're approaching on singularity where the artificial intelligence becomes exponential and completely transforms the human experience. Some of these transformations include the very types of technology that would need to be created for this kind of thing to happen. It may take a few hundred years, but given the current pace of technology, it's not completely out of the question, scientifically speaking. You might be wondering, in 200 years or so, why would somebody want to resurrect me? Wouldn't they have forgotten all about me at that point? Well, they might have. But it's easy to imagine somebody wanting to resurrect their dead relatives, and those dead relatives, when brought back, might want to resurrect their parents, who in turn might want to resurrect their grandparents, and so on. A popular early 2000s movie starring Tom Cruise kind of touched on something similar to this theory as part of its plotline. It's called Vanilla Sky. Check it out, it's worth a watch. It's directed by Cameron Crowe, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. Now, obviously, all of this is speculation. Simple what-ifs and daydreams at the moment. We've got to actually create the singularity initially. Also, as with everything else in this balanced world, the singularity would have to be created in the right way. As for every singularity created in terms of utopias, there could also be a singularity which leads to nightmares. In many ways, the search for ongoing discovery in science has taken us full circle. That being the idea of a superintelligent AI eventually making the impossible possible is somewhat of a substitute for what we've always considered to be God, putting faith in the future instead of faith in the spiritual. Projecting humans back in time, biological teleportation, the transference of consciousness, these are all particularly hard problems to solve. Significant scientific mountains to climb that we are nowhere near close to achieving, and that none of us are likely to witness within our lifetimes. But it's all a fascinating concept. Death is inevitable. You listening to this will die someday. Think about that. So when a mysterious phenomenon that happens at the time of your death comes up for question and debate, it's commonplace to not want to put a lot of meaning onto it. It's easy to make it bigger than it might actually be. I guess it's something that gives us hope. Some refer to this as death denial, where we don't claim ideas or beliefs that give us hope that there might be something after this, that this isn't just all there is. I'm curious how many of you guys have actually been faced with the end of your life but survived, or come back from the edge, so to speak. How did it change you? Have any of you guys listening ever had a near-death experience? What do you think is the best explanation for this phenomenon? Email me, DM me, I'm always enthralled to hear you guys' viewpoints. I would love, as always, to hear your comments, thoughts, and experiences. Let's talk. So, one final thought. I mentioned earlier we would come back to this, so I thought it would be a good place to end tonight's episode on, as it has an element of full circle to it. Well, does our existence serve a higher purpose that we have no way or ability of seeing ourselves? Emergence theory says it could. Astrophysics says that the atoms in our bodies are the same as the atoms scattered all throughout the universe, and we are a part of that infinity. Quantum physics says that all those atoms have some atomic particles that communicate instantaneously with each other, such as how we discussed earlier with quantum entanglement. Well, all of these things point to some very interesting possibilities. And I don't think that some kind of universal super consciousness or something that we could perceive as a god or godlike element is really out of the question. Hear me out on this one. The field of study, known as emergence theory, is something that some scientists are starting to take a significant interest in. Quote, emergence is a process whereby larger entities' patterns and regularities arise through interactions among smaller or simpler entities that themselves do not exhibit such properties. Unquote. To put it simply, an ant, for example, has a tiny little brain. It just has some encoded instructions in its little cluster of neurons that it follows, and has no idea that it is working towards a bigger goal throughout its entire colony of creating entire cities underground. Each cell in your body has tiny little proteins and subcellular mechanisms that are just going about their business, doing the small thing that they are programmed to do. They have no idea that they are serving a bigger purpose of keeping the larger and whole cell alive. The cell, similarly, does its thing and goes about its business and has no idea that it's serving the larger purpose of keeping the human body alive. It doesn't even know it's part of a human body. It's too big for it to comprehend and has no vantage point to become aware of it. Additionally, humans do their thing, living their lives and going about their business, potentially having no idea that we are extremely tiny parts of a much bigger existence. Something that we have no awareness of, no vantage point to observe, and no ability to even comprehend the bigger picture. A tiny ant that scurries about beneath your shoe, completely oblivious to your existence, unable to even comprehend or understand that you exist or what you are, what if, in another scenario, we are the ants? Now, none of this really speaks for organized religion. I think that's really more of a societal and psychological thing. But that's all for tonight, friends. Don't forget to reach out. I look forward to hearing from you. Good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.